Cops, what has so far been the creepiest call you've ever had to respond to, and what happened? Story 1. Got a call about a missing child. Arrived at the home to find the mother highly distressed and unsure what to do. I called in everyone to first search the home and property. I decided to search the backyard since it was a large wooded lot with no visible fence. After about 10 minutes, I found the boy, caught on an old chain-link fence in the woods that was hidden by a bunch of trees, so you couldn't see it from the house. He must have been climbing on it, fell, and got his hooded sweatshirt stuck. The hardest part for me was having to call it in on the radio, knowing the mother might overhear it from one of the other officers' radios. Story 2. Working third shift on Halloween night, I was out by one of our smaller lakes just outside the city limits. Kids love to go out and hang around, which is surrounded by some very nice houses. Going through the neighborhood, each of the roads ends at a small two-lane road that surrounds the lake. I slowed to the stop sign and was already starting to look to my right to make the turn when my headlights traced the rock wall that borders the lake, and I caught something out of the corner of my eye in one of the large trees along the path. I backed up to see what it was and saw a man hanging. At first, I thought it was a Halloween decoration. The neighborhood goes all out for every holiday. So I stopped, got out, and as soon as my flashlight hit him, I realized it wasn't a decoration. As I was standing there getting ready to call it in, I noticed a group of kids coming down the street trick-or-treating. As soon as they saw my car, they started heading my way faster, so I hurried back up the block to meet the parent walking with them and told her she needed to take the long way around. She could see from my face that I wasn't joking. It turned out he was a 20-year-old who had been devastated about his girlfriend breaking up with him, and she lived in the last house on that block where she would have seen him the next morning from her window. Story 3. We responded to a burglary alarm at a mortuary and found that one of the rear doors was left open. Policy now dictates that the entire building needs to be cleared, searched, to confirm that it was a false alarm, which most are. It was the middle of the night and totally dark. We used flashlights and never turned on lights. We walked into one of the rooms and saw a body on a table. It appeared to be waiting to be processed, possibly embalmed by the mortician. It smelled like a mildly decomposing body. Suddenly, I saw a shadow to my right and shined my light there, but found nothing out of the ordinary. I immediately smelled a really strong whiff of perfume blow by me. The search was completed much faster than normal after that. Nothing was found. Story 4. I responded to a report of an unresponsive infant. When I arrived, all the family members were standing casually in the front yard, pointing into the house. I found the baby in the back room lying on her back on a bare mattress. I started CPR but realized the baby was probably already gone. We rushed her out to the arriving ambulance, hoping they had a way to bring her back. I learned she was the mother's second suspicious SIDS case, and I had her other children removed from her care. The most difficult part came when I left the scene and went to the ER to see what came of the situation. As I walked in and asked where she was, an ER nurse walked over to me and handed me the baby swaddled in a blanket, telling me to wait for someone to show me to the morgue. So I was standing there in the ER, in uniform, holding what everyone thought was a live infant, while several people stopped by wanting to see her and commenting on how cute it was to see an officer holding a baby. I just smiled, but it tore me apart inside. I was ushered back to the morgue after what felt like an eternity and told I had to wait with the baby until the medical examiner arrived. They removed the blankets and laid her on a stainless steel gurney, leaving me alone with her again. I lingered around the morgue for about an hour waiting. By the time I got home several hours after the end of my shift, because this call came out 15 minutes before the end of my 10-hour shift, I lay down on my bed and cried for a long time. My young daughter was in daycare, and my wife was at work. I really needed to hold both of them, so the house felt incredibly empty. My daughter was only slightly older than the infant, and when I was looking at her earlier, I kept seeing my own child. I didn't get any sleep at all before going back in for the next shift later that night. Story 5. Got a call that someone wasn't answering their phone or the doorbell. We got to the house and noticed that every window was covered, either by curtains or pieces of paper. We rang the doorbell and yelled through the letterbox, but there was no answer. We opened the door and went inside. In the house, it looked like someone had just had lunch. There was bread on the table and juice or milk in the glasses. Children's toys were scattered all around. Then I saw a note that gave me chills. It was a Suic note. As the door was locked from the inside, the person had to be in the house. We checked room by room, and my heartbeat was at 300% when I checked the bathroom. Preparing myself for what I might see, I opened the door slowly, but there was nothing. Finally, one more room was left, the attic. We walked slowly up the stairs and found the resident there, hanging from a beam. I will never forget the adrenaline I felt, the scene in the living room, or the resident we found. Story 6. Not a cop myself, but my dad is, and I asked him this one time. He told me it was when he went to a house after a woman called saying men were breaking in. When he arrived, it was immediately clear the woman was not entirely stable. She kept mumbling and was very jumpy and skittish. Every single wall of her house apparently had at least 6 or 7 crosses on it, if not more. He calmed her down, checked around the house for any signs of entry, but found absolutely nothing to suggest anyone had been trying or had managed to break in. She followed him around the entire time, pointing to things like a doorknob or window latches, insisting, "Oh, that's not where I left it. That's how they got in." He said the whole thing was fairly eerie, especially considering it was the middle of the night. He was surrounded by crosses, and she kept mumbling about random things. To help her feel better, he did a full sweep of the house to see if anyone else was inside, but there wasn't. The one thing that unsettled him most was how, every few minutes, she would say things like, "Oh, they're here again," or, "He's right behind us. I can feel it." Story 7. I worked in a high-tech task force agency conducting computer forensics investigations. A lot of disturbing material came through those cases. Anyway, we were doing a multi-agency search warrant sweep in a large metro area in California. We served a warrant for distributing illegal content at a residence in a semi-decent area, and the suspect looked exactly like the stereotypical shady character you'd imagine. He lived with his disabled wife, no kids, and she had mobility issues. She mostly stayed downstairs and hadn't been upstairs in years. We went upstairs and found that he had a locked room with a very unsettling setup. The room was dark, windows covered, and filled with altered dolls arranged in disturbing ways. Some were missing parts, others had been cut open, and the overall scene was extremely disturbing. It was clear this guy had very serious issues. Story 8. Got called to assist an ambulance at an address because they were struggling with a woman who'd had an apparent seizure. We got there and found a very small, thin Singaporean woman being held down on the floor by a paramedic. She was hissing, struggling, and repeatedly trying to bite. Her eyes looked dark and bloodshot, and it took me 200 pounds, my partner, approximately 180 pounds, plus 3 paramedics to hold her down. The entire time she was straining, veins bulging, screaming at something in the corner of the room that wasn't there, yelling at it not to hurt her or us. Her husband, oddly calm, told us this had been happening since she last went to Singapore and got sick after visiting a holy site. He said her sister usually stopped it by putting some kind of powder on her forehead in the shape of a cross, but she was out of the country. In the end, the paramedics took her to the hospital for a mental health assessment. I often wonder what the outcome was, but I'll never know. Story 9. Got a report of a missing husband. He told his wife and 6 children that he was going to get his tires changed, but never returned. This was 12 hours ago. They had purchased another house in a nearby community, and with the marriage under strain, the wife assumed he was staying there. She insisted he would never harm himself. The strange thing was, he had emptied his personal bank account into his wife's that morning. She explained it away by saying they had recently fought about money, and he agreed she should control their finances. On a hunch, I asked his 14-year-old son if there were any places in the mountains nearby that his father liked. The boy pointed out a road about 10 miles away. Nearing midnight, I drove up that old, abandoned Forest Service road in the snow, convinced I would find him either thinking about or already having carried something out. I reached the top after an hour, but no truck. On the way down, I debated how unreliable gut feelings usually are, but something about this one felt different. There were dozens of smaller side roads branching off, and though it was late and resources were limited, I chose one at random. About 100 yards past the first corner, my headlights lit up the back of a black truck. Even without memorizing the plate, I knew it was his. My heart was pounding as I walked to it. Inside, I found the man had ended his life. I'll spare you the details, but it was a devastating scene. I had to wait 3 hours by the truck until body removal arrived. The worst part was going to the family, who had been waiting for good news and instead telling them the word.
Hey there, are you sitting down? Good, because Wayfair's end of season sale is here and you can shop it from your couch. It's Wayfair's Labor Day clearance and it's on now. Right now, you can score up to 70% off everything home at Wayfair, like up to 50% off outdoor furniture and decor, and up to 70% off area rugs, plus amazing doorbuster deals, and 24-hour surprise flash deals on Wayfair home finds in every style. And get it all with fast shipping on everything right to your door. From furniture to faucets, this is your last chance of the season to score huge deals at Wayfair. Don't let the final days of summer pass you by without shopping these end-of-season savings. So don't wait. Like summer, these savings won't last. Head to Wayfair.com today to score up to 70% off everything home. Celebrate your holiday weekend with can't-miss savings before they run out. Shop Wayfair's Labor Day clearance now through September 2nd at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Possible outcome. To this day, the way that gut feeling played out still unsettles me. Storyten. An elderly woman called in reporting that a man carrying a drawstring bag was walking around her and her husband's property. She described the man as moving like a zombie, staring at the ground the entire time. She wasn't able to tell if he was trying to break in or just wandering aimlessly, but it scared her enough to call. My partner and I were about 15 minutes away when the call came in from dispatch. When we were about halfway there, the woman reported again, saying that her husband, who had been watching the yard from inside the front door with a shotgun in hand, told her he saw the trespasser walk across the street and disappear into the cornfield. The description was still vague, but the way she spoke made us take it seriously. We arrived and quickly searched around the cornfield, looking for fresh tracks or signs of movement, but it was pitch black and quiet. After checking the perimeter, we went to the house. I started taking statements from both the husband and wife. The man was still visibly on edge, describing how he watched the figure move without ever looking up and how unsettling it was. My partner searched the property for any signs of tampering or attempted entry, but there was nothing obvious. Afterward, we patrolled the area slowly for about 10 to 15 minutes, driving the surrounding roads and scanning the edges of the field with our spotlights. Despite the eerie atmosphere and the uneasy feeling of being watched, we never found the man. Story 11. This was probably around 2010 or 2011, back when I was really new on the job. A call came in marked as an unknown problem, which usually means the 911 operator had so little clear information that even dispatch didn't know how to categorize it. That alone made us all tense. When we arrived, we learned that the man at the center of the call had already murdered his stepfather, then walked over to his grandparents' house with the intent to kill them too. He had stabbed his grandmother through the eye with a huge survival knife, the kind that had a compass in the handle. The shocking part was that by sheer luck, the blade missed her brain by less than an inch. She didn't die. Instead, when we pulled up, she came running out of the house with this massive knife sticking out of her eye, the compass spinning as she moved. My brain shut down for a moment, and I thought, there's no way that's real. I actually ran right past her with several other officers because we couldn't comprehend what we were seeing. It wasn't until the sergeant yelled, "What are you doing?" that it hit me this woman was alive, injured, and needed immediate help. She survived against all odds, and we managed to catch the guy later through a stroke of pure luck. To this day, that image, an elderly woman, knife lodged in her face and still on her feet, is one of the most surreal and disturbing things I've ever witnessed. Story 12. I was working as a detention officer at the local jail when we had a guy brought in around 2 a.m. From the moment he walked through the door, we knew it was going to be a problem. His movements were sharp and jerky, snapping his head back and forth like he was scanning the entire room, eyes darting everywhere, muttering constantly. A co-worker and I decided to stay with the booking officer to back her up once things escalated. The man rambled the entire time. Some of what he said made sense, but most of it was gibberish strung together into nonsense. At one point, he stopped, looked straight at my co-worker, and asked in a strange tone, "Would you blame me for it?" My co-worker, trying to keep him calm, responded casually, "Nah, man, no one can blame you." For some reason, those words sent him into a frenzy. He leapt from the bench so fast that the handcuff attached to one wrist nearly ripped it from the wall. We both pushed him back, and my co-worker struggled to get the other wrist cuffed while I held him against the wall with all my strength. The guy was unbelievably strong, like his adrenaline had given him superhuman energy. It honestly felt like the heavy bench was about to come up off the concrete floor. When we finally got both wrists cuffed, he threw his head back, rolled his eyes completely until there was no white showing, and let out a scream that I can only describe as inhuman. It was deep, guttural, and chilling, something I had only ever heard in movies about possession. He then moved his head around as if looking at different people in the room, but his eyes were still rolled back, and he continued spewing more incoherent nonsense. This cycle went on for about 45 minutes. He would thrash violently, scream and rant in strange voices, then suddenly calm down for a minute or two, talking to us like a normal person, before switching back into that terrifying state again. Every time he went back into it, the noise and the way his eyes rolled back made the hairs on my arms stand up. I'm not Catholic, but standing in that room, listening to those sounds, I came very close to crossing myself. It was one of the most unnerving encounters I ever had inside the jail. Story 13. Not me, but my friend is a cop in a major Canadian city. One night we had plans to hang out after his shift, so he decided to pick me up in his patrol car, since he was nearly finished and just had to return it to the depot. On the way, he got a call about someone reporting strange noises in their basement that sounded like a person, so he decided to check it out as his last stop. I waited in the car while he went with the homeowner. He was gone for about half an hour, and when he came back, his face showed a mix of fear and disbelief. Apparently, the homeowner had been hearing loud thuds from the basement for weeks, but that night the noises were so loud they terrified him. Since it was a walk-in basement, he thought someone might have broken in. My friend went down with the homeowner to check. It was completely dark, and the lights had to be turned on from the electrical panel. As they reached the panel, my friend said he caught movement in the corner of his eye. At the far end of a hallway that led to a cold storage room, he saw a figure, someone standing still, facing the door. He yelled for the man to turn around, but there was no response. The homeowner saw it too and was terrified. My friend demanded once more that the figure turn, then hit the switch for the lights. In that instant, the figure vanished. He swore he searched every inch of the basement, but found nothing. The homeowner, shaken, decided to stay at a friend's house that night. My friend even had another officer watch the property in case someone tried to enter again. To this day, he swears he saw someone down there. Story 14. Not mine, but my sibling is a police officer and told me a story I'll never forget. He was responding to a domestic disturbance in a rundown apartment complex near Detroit. Neighbors reported hearing an hour of screaming and banging from an upstairs unit before everything went silent. No one called until a foul smell started seeping out. My brother and his partner went to the door. They knocked, got no answer, just the sound of a faint meow. The door was unlocked, so they entered. The living room was trashed, TV busted, holes punched into the walls, furniture overturned. Nothing unusual for a violent fight, but there were supposed to be two people, and so far there was no one. They checked the bedroom. My brother pushed on the door, but it barely budged. It was blocked. He gave his partner a look, then forced it open. A cat darted out, its once white fur stained pink around the mouth. Behind the door was the woman, slumped against it, beaten so severely she was barely recognizable. A piece of the bed frame had been ripped off and used as a weapon. Bloody handprints trailed the room, circling from the bed to the walls, smearing across the window as she tried desperately to claw it open, even breaking her nails against the sill. But the window had been nailed shut. The trail of prints went full circle around the room until her body finally collapsed by the door. The most haunting detail, the cat had begun to feed in desperation. The attacker, her live-in boyfriend, was never caught. He had been supplying her with drugs. The cat was rescued and given to a loving home. Story 15. My dad worked in a precinct in New York City that once had one of the highest murder rates. Even 15 years after retiring, he refuses to share most of what he saw because of the nightmares. But one night after drinking, he told us a story that has haunted me ever since. A woman in her 20s was returning home late from work. She entered her apartment building and waited for the elevator. When it arrived, only one man was inside. He gave her a bad feeling, but she got in anyway and pressed her floor. That's when she noticed the basement button had already been pressed. Normally after 9 p.m., the basement button was locked by maintenance to keep people out, but that night someone had forgotten. The man forced her into the basement. He tied her up and held her there for hours, assaulting her. Then he took her apartment key, rode up to her floor, and tried every door until he found hers. Inside, her roommate, also a woman in her 20s, was taken to the basement too. Both women were tortured through the night until dawn. It wasn't until maintenance came in the morning that they were discovered. My dad was one of the first responders. He rarely talks about his time on the job, but this story stuck with him, likely because he has four daughters of his own. Out of all the horrors he's seen, he said this was one of the darkest. Story 16. Not a cop, but my dad's friend is. And he got totally hammered at our house a few days ago and told us about one of his first rough calls. It involved a little girl who showed up to school with patches of hair missing from her head. The teachers quickly realized something was wrong and suspected abuse. They called the police when the parents didn't show up at the school. When officers arrived at the house, they found the girl's mother so badly beaten that both of her eyes were swollen shut. She couldn't even see. Her daughter couldn't recognize her own mom. The father had apparently been furious because the mother sent the girl to school when he wanted to keep her home to avoid suspicion. When he woke up and realized she had gone, he snapped. By the time police got there, he had locked himself in his room upstairs. He eventually jumped out a window and tried to run, making it pretty far, until he ran into a K-9 unit. He attempted to keep running, but the dog stopped him fast. He was badly injured, but to this day, my dad's friend said he'd never felt so relieved to see someone get exactly what they deserved. Sadly, it wasn't much of a happy ending for the girl, given everything she'd already been through. Story 17. I once went to do a welfare check. A neighbor had called, saying he hadn't seen the man who lived there in a few days, and that the lights in the house had been on nonstop. I arrived and started looking around. There were no footprints or tire tracks in the fresh snow from a recent storm. The garage was empty, but the house was unlocked. Inside, I found his phone, keys, wallet, and cash sitting out, with the TV still on. At that point, I realized this wasn't a routine welfare check anymore. It was likely a recovery. I searched the entire house, the garage, and the property. He had several old junk cars scattered around, but there were no fresh tracks, no footprints, nothing. I called every recent number on his phone, but no one had heard from him. Eventually, all I could do was issue a be on the lookout and begin paperwork for NCIC. The next day, a day shift officer followed up. Turns out the man had been plowing his driveway a week before I got the call when either a medical event struck or something caused him to pass out. His truck crashed into the junk vehicles and the wreck caught fire. What was left of him was only a pile of burned remains in the driver's seat, now buried under snow. I felt awful that I hadn't found him that night, but the creepiest part was knowing that I had been searching the property with his body only inches away from me, hidden under snow and wreckage. Story 18. I was a military police officer, so I worked both law enforcement and corrections. At our corrections facility, the main office doubled as the police services desk. The phones would sometimes ring with no one on the other end. One time it rang, and instead of showing a normal number, the caller ID just displayed a strange label, something like Emergency Phone 11. I was new at the time, so I called my superiors immediately. They told me to drop it and never report anything like that again. That stuck with me. Later, while on patrol, I got dispatched to the abandoned side of the base. Radio said there was an emergency phone call, but at first they couldn't identify the location. The dispatcher was new and didn't know that Emergency Phone 11 wasn't supposed to be acknowledged. He even said the caller sounded frantic, claiming someone was chasing them. After digging through old base maps, radio finally found the label for Emergency Phone 11 and sent me and my partner there in a hurry. When we arrived, there was nothing, just a broken pole where a phone had once been. No working line, no equipment, just emptiness. Filing that report was one of the strangest experiences of my career. Story 19, ex-military police here. I once responded to a call involving a woman who was outside her home screaming, wearing only a t-shirt, with blood running down her legs. She was the wife of a serviceman, and she had been assaulted brutally. While en route, I was notified that there were also three dependents inside the home, unknown ages, but all under 18. I got the wife on the ground to wait for medical help as backup and an ambulance arrived. Then I entered the house with my sidearm drawn. The serviceman was unconscious on the living room floor, lying in a pool of vomit. Two children sat on the couch, clinging to each other in terror. I gathered the kids and got them outside to be with their mother. The house itself was hellish. It looked as though a bomb filled with cigarettes, alcohol, dirty diapers, and rotting food had detonated inside. The smell and filth were overwhelming. I knew I still had to find the third child. I checked the serviceman's pulse. He was alive, and made my way to the back room. There was a crib. It was silent. I steeled myself for the worst. When I leaned over, I saw the baby, thankfully alive, chest rising and falling, but covered in filth. Dried waste had caked the baby's legs, back and bottom. It was clear the infant had been left neglected for some time. The ambulance arrived, and I demanded they take the infant immediately. The base ombudsman woman showed up, panicked, and I called my supervisor, who was on leave, ordering him to get there fast. That was the day I knew I didn't want a career in law enforcement after my enlistment ended. That scene ended it for me. Story 20. I was working in the crime unit for the state police agency when patrol was sent to check out a second-floor apartment in a small town. Neighbors had reported an unbearable stench coming from inside. Patrol forced entry and discovered the resident deceased from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. On my way there, the coroner, who also volunteered with the local EMS, called me and said, "Bring your hazmat suit. This one's bad." I could smell it from the street as I arrived. Upstairs, waves of flies filled the air. Inside the bedroom, what I saw barely resembled a human body. It was mid-July, nearly 90 degrees, and the heat had accelerated decomposition. The man's body had turned completely black, and he had literally melted into the floor. One of the forensic techs asked why his skin seemed to be moving. That's when we realized thousands of maggots were beneath the surface, creating the illusion of bubbling, shifting skin. The handgun was still clenched tightly in his right hand, fused there. It took the fire department using shovels to remove what was left from the floor. The smell was unlike anything I've ever encountered, even worse than swamp recoveries, bloated lake bodies, or heat victims. It's the kind of smell that sears into memory, the kind you can never forget. Story 21. Christmas morning, 2004. Our station got a strange call from another precinct nearly 600 kilometers away. A young man in his late teens had walked in and confessed to shooting his grandmother the night before, then driving all the way from Johannesburg to Durban. I was the detective on duty, and since no patrol unit was nearby, my partner and I went to check the address. The house was locked, silent. Unsure if it was a prank, I started searching for another way in. I managed to pry open a bedroom window, and what I saw still chills me. An elderly woman, face bloodied, eyes wide and bewildered, staring up at me. We forced the door and found her alive, though shot in the head with a .22. Somehow she had survived the night, lying helpless in bed while the TV blared in a language she didn't even understand. She was a French immigrant. The house reeked of waste. She had soiled herself repeatedly. While waiting for the ambulance, I tried spraying perfume to mask the smell, but it only fused into something far worse. That scent, perfume mixed with death, stayed with me for years. She died later that week in the hospital. The grandson had stolen a neighbor's car, fled toward Durban, and was eventually overcome with guilt, turning himself in. He was charged with murder. That Christmas, instead of celebration, I had to tell her family the truth. It's a story that has never left me. Story 22. I worked as a parks officer in a downtown metropolitan area in the Pacific Northwest. On my night shift, I saw more than my fair share of strange things. Everything from the naked bike ride after party at midnight with 1,000 people hanging around unclothed, to couples having whists in public, homeless people shooting up or doing other things out in the open, and even the occasional dead body. It was all part of the job. One night around 11:30 p.m., we were sent to investigate a tent that had been pitched near the waterfront. Usually this just meant a homeless person trying to stay dry, so we expected a routine interaction. We told the woman inside she had to move a few hundred yards away to an area that wasn't patrolled. She complained about having to relocate, then suddenly mentioned something much stranger, a man living in a cave at the bottom of a shallow ravine nearby. She claimed he had been killing small animals and eating them. Curious, we pressed her for more details. She pointed toward an area about 50 yards away through thick brush. the sort of place most people wouldn't go. My partner and I pushed through with only our flashlights until we stumbled across the ravine. Sure enough, there was a small opening in the side, just big enough for a person to crawl inside. I scaled down about 20 feet and peeked inside. What I found was bizarre: a huge pile of magazines and torn pages, articles of clothing, a sugar cookie tin, the hand of a gorilla costume, some crude-looking tools including a makeshift bow, several knives, and other random oddities. Being curious, and since the cave was empty, I opened the cookie tin. Inside was a large amount of raw meat, what looked like animal flesh. At that point, the hair on the back of my neck stood up. I got out of there fast and radioed for the police, since we didn't carry weapons. We never found out who the man was or what exactly was going on in that cave, but being deep in the brush at midnight, surrounded by piles of bizarre objects and raw meat, was one of the creepiest moments of my time on the job. Story 23. I'm not a cop, but back in college, we had an assignment in my writing class to interview someone in a profession we wanted to go into. One of my classmates interviewed a detective. Later in class, we shared the interviews aloud to showcase our writing and questioning skills. The detective was asked what case had freaked him out the most. He said there was one call that still haunted him. It was the scene of a dead child. He arrived at a home to find a boy, about 10 years old, lying lifeless on the floor of the dining room with blunt force trauma to his head. The boy's grandmother was present. She just stood there staring at him. No remorse, no sadness, nothing. The detective recalled that she was of Asian heritage, though he wasn't sure exactly from where. When he asked what had happened, she calmly told him the boy had fallen, but something felt off, her demeanor, her detachment. As he searched the house, he found a separate room filled with disturbing ritual items and strange markings. The investigation soon revealed something chilling. The grandmother had intended to sacrifice the child as part of a ritual she believed would lift a curse on their family. She was arrested. Even then, she insisted she had done nothing wrong, repeating in broken English that she was only helping her family. The detective told my classmate that the image of that boy on the dining room floor and the grandmother's unflinching stare stayed with him forever. It was the single most haunting case of his career. Story 24. I worked as a 9/11 dispatcher, and one night I received a call from an elderly woman who was struggling to breathe. I had taken several calls from her and her husband before, so I immediately recognized her voice. I dispatched an ambulance to her home and kept her on the line, trying to calm her while they were en route. Since she lived in a very rural part of West Virginia, the ambulance advised they had a 15-minute ETA. I talked with her about her husband, made small talk, and did everything I could to keep her steady until help arrived. When the ambulance finally radioed that they were pulling up, I let her know and told her to go answer the door. She said, okay, hung up the phone, and that was the last thing I heard from her. Here's where it gets strange. A minute later, the EMTs on scene radioed back saying no one was answering the door. A sheriff's unit nearby arrived and confirmed the address before forcing entry. 5 minutes later, the paramedic radioed in, asking who the caller had been. I told him it was the elderly woman. He immediately requested to speak with my supervisor. They confirmed the call had come from her, but the medics on scene said she had already been dead for some time, fully in rigor mortis. They thought I must have been mistaken, but we played back the recording in dispatch, and it was clearly her voice, speaking with me. The hospital staff didn't believe it either until they heard the tape. That night, I took a call from someone who had already passed away. Story 25. I was interning with a sheriff's department, mostly riding along on patrol. One day, we were sent to do a welfare check. The deputy thought it would be routine. Maybe the woman was out of town. When we arrived, the neighbors told us they hadn't seen her in weeks. The mail was piled up and packages sat untouched on the porch. We checked the front door and found it unlocked. But when the deputy pushed it open, it only budged a few inches before jamming. The house was one of those split-level homes where the stairs meet at the entryway, so at first we thought maybe clutter was blocking it. The deputy mentioned that the woman was known to be a hoarder. He added something I'll never forget. If you see flies on the windows, she's probably inside and she's probably dead. As we walked around the house, we saw them. Dozens of flies on the windows. Looking through the glass, we saw mountains of trash bags, diapers, and debris stacked everywhere. The back door was locked, so we returned to the front. This time, the deputy pushed harder. As the door opened a little more, a thick, grease-like liquid spread out from under it. He stopped, shut the door again, and calmly said, "She's behind the door. We called it in. Based on the dates on the packages, she had been gone for about 2 months. When entry was finally made, I was allowed inside. I'll never forget what I saw. Her body no longer looked human, sagging and melted into the floor, her face blackened, parts of it eaten down to the bone by maggots. The smell when the coroners moved her body was overwhelming, like something alive pressing against you. The deputy had been right. It was likely she had fallen and either died there or been trapped, unable to move, waiting for help that never came. That thought, the possibility that she had lain there alive for some time, has haunted me ever since. Story 26. I was brand new on the force and sent to a home invasion call late at night. Strangely, my training officer didn't seem too concerned and drove slower than usual, which was very unlike the normal urgency for an in-progress crime. When we arrived, he asked if I had ever been to that house before. I said no. He just smirked and told me to handle it on my own. As I walked up to the home, the garage door opened and out hobbled an elderly woman bent forward nearly at a 90-degree angle. Without looking at me, she told me to hurry because the suspects were still inside. She used much more colorful and very racist language. I noticed right away that she couldn't straighten her back and seemed mentally unstable. I followed her inside, and as my eyes adjusted, I heard a clicking sound. She was locking two padlocks on the inside of the door behind me. That's when I realized something was off. Every cabinet in the kitchen had padlocks, and down the hall, every interior door was also secured with locks. She led me to one door, unlocked it, and shouted, "They're in here!" Inside, I found an older man calmly sitting at a desk using a computer. He looked up, greeted me, identified himself as her husband, then went right back to his screen. She then pointed to an empty chair and yelled, "They're under the chair! Oh no, they just ran outside right there!" pointing directly at a blank wall. After she locked her husband back in the room, she eventually let me back out through the padlocked kitchen door. I rushed outside, cursing my training officer under my breath. That was my first real exposure to severe mental illness, and it was deeply unsettling. Later, my training officer explained that years earlier, the woman had been assaulted, and the trauma had broken her mentally. That's what fueled her paranoia and racism. Story 27. I was an MP in the Army back in 2005 when this happened. Early in a shift, we were called to secure a crime scene and on-post housing for lower enlisted soldiers. When we got there, CID investigators gave us only a vague overview. A 19-year-old infantryman, freshly back from deployment, had brutally murdered his young wife. She was just 17 or 18. We weren't told much at first, but from outside the house, we could already see details that looked like something out of a horror movie. The back door was open, and tiny bloody paw prints covered the porch. Inside, bloodstains showed a body had been dragged across the carpet, with the dog's prints scattered everywhere through the mess. Looking in from the front kitchen window, we saw the worst of it. Though the body had already been removed, the scene was unmistakable. A giant pool of blood marked where she had died. Around her head were knives arranged in a strange circle, like a halo. Scrawled across the refrigerator, written in blood, were the words, "Satan said she deserved it." Several days later, while securing the morgue, I was asked to sit in on the autopsy. I can still see it in my mind. She had been stabbed 50 to 60 times. A meat cleaver was lodged in her neck, left in place. Her lower jaw was nearly gone, her tongue resting unnaturally low. Carved into her chest was a perfect pentagram, so precise it looked like it was done with a ruler. One of her hands showed where she had tried to block a blow. Three of her fingers hung by scraps of skin. The most horrific part was when the doctors pulled a 14-inch knife sharpener from inside her body. They believed she was already dead when it happened, which, as terrible as it was, felt like the only small relief. I had already done two tours in Iraq and seen plenty of combat, but nothing compared to that day. The week we spent guarding that crime scene and the hours I spent in that autopsy forever changed how I see humanity. Writing it down even now, all these years later, brings back the weight of that moment. Story 28. About 9 years ago, we got a call from a payphone. There's a dead body in the abandoned building at the corner of First and Main. Street names made up. An officer went out but couldn't find anything that even looked abandoned. The caller hung up without leaving any details. The payphone itself was several miles away from that intersection. The officer cleared the call as unfounded. The next day, another call came in from a different payphone. Same message. There's a dead body inside the abandoned building at First and Main. Again, the caller hung up. This time I was dispatched. I started canvassing the area. At that time, the economy was still booming, so abandoned buildings were rare. I searched all the shopping plazas, warehouses, and industrial spots near the intersection and came up with nothing. I widened the search and remembered a nearby unfinished construction project. I wondered if the caller mistook those structures for abandoned. I walked through half-finished businesses, just framing and plywood, but found nothing. As I pulled away, I was already a mile or more from the original call location. At a stoplight, I looked ahead and saw it, a massive electrical component factory, surrounded by a 9-foot wall. The place had been vacant for at least 15 years. The landscaping was still maintained, so it didn't stand out at first glance. I called for backup, and together we scaled the wall through a drainage pipe. The building was massive, over 100,000 square feet. Old coolers, pipes, ductwork, loading docks, and even a basement. Every door we checked was locked, until one suddenly swung open. We knocked, announced, and entered. The moment we stepped in, the door slammed shut, plunging us into total darkness. Pitch black. The hall stretched 100 yards with rooms branching off on both sides. The layout was confusing. Each room seemed to connect to several more. One room, likely an old clean room, was dead silent. No echoes, no hum of traffic, no air movement. Just void. It freaked us out. The floor had random holes leading to a flooded basement 6 feet below. Loose wires, panels, debris, and shattered glass were everywhere. It felt like the perfect set for a horror film. We pushed through, clearing room after room, until we reached the industrial section. Massive boilers, evaporators, and more machinery. Oh, and spiders, hundreds of them. Finally, we reached a dead-end room, about 20 by 30 feet, lined with 5 giant electrical cabinets, 8 feet tall and 4 feet wide. They looked like something out of a science fiction villain's lair. All were dark except for the center panel, which glowed with a single red light. I told my partner I'd check behind the cabinets before we left. There was a narrow gap between them and the wall, maybe 2 feet. I peeked around one side and nearly fired my weapon. There he was, a body wedged on the ground between the wall and cabinet. On his back, arms bent up like a T-Rex with obvious injuries. Even though I'd been searching for a dead body the whole time, seeing it in that moment scared the hell out of me. Detectives later determined he was a copper thief. Stripping copper from abandoned buildings had just started becoming common. The wiring scraps we'd seen made sense now. He and a partner had been systematically gutting the place for months, probably hauling away hundreds of thousands in stolen copper. The catch was that this one section of the building still had live power. It ran the fire suppression system required by the insurance policy. The thief must have thought he'd struck gold when he saw the thick copper cables. He cut one successfully, exposing its sharp ends. But when he went for the second, the live current surged through him. The shock locked up his muscles, pulling him into the cabinet where the jagged end of the first cable impaled his chest. Instant death. What stuck with me most was that his accomplice never came forward. The man's family swore they knew nothing about his copper thefts. So after months of stealing together, the partner left him there to rot alone in the dark, in the back of a forgotten factory. One of the creepiest and most memorable cases I ever worked, and the perfect example of no honor among thieves. Story 29. This one isn't exactly creepy in the ghost story sense, but it was about my father's very first call with the fire department, and it stuck with him forever. They got a call for a man who had attempted suicide. The details were minimal, just possible gunshot wound. When they arrived and went inside, they found a man in his mid-20s lying on the floor. At his feet was a shotgun. My dad told me there was more blood than you'd think a human body could hold. Shocked, he said out loud, "Oh my God, this guy's got to be dead. Look at all the blood." But one of the senior firefighters glanced at him and said, "Huh. You'd think so, wouldn't you? That's nothing. Get over here and hold this guy's skull for me. He's still breathing." So there's my dad, 23 years old, brand new on the job, suddenly holding this man's shattered skull together while paramedics worked to keep him alive. He later told me that in that moment, all he could think was, Jesus Christ, what the hell did I sign up for? I just left a good-paying job where they offered me a manager's position, and I left it to join the fire department because my dad and grandfather said the benefits were good and it was a rewarding career. The man survived the scene and was rushed to the hospital, but he suffered severe brain damage. My dad never knew how long he lived afterward. Still, he said it was one of the worst things he'd ever endured. Right up there with calls involving children and fatal car crashes. When they returned to the station, the chief called my dad into his office. He told him, look, I don't even know where to start after a call like that. Last time we had something similar was 15 years ago. These things don't happen often, and I'll understand if you want to take the week off. That was one of the worst I've seen, and I'm sorry it was your first. My dad took the next day off, but then went back the rest of the week. That was the beginning of his career. He's one of my biggest heroes. He's seen and endured things most people couldn't imagine. I miss being near him and my grandfather, who also served in wars and the fire department. Even though we talk all the time, I miss the hugs and just hanging out with them. Writing this out makes me tear up before my shift at work, so I'll leave it there. Story 30. Not a cop myself, but my buddy told me about one of the darkest cases he ever worked. He had arrested a man and his girlfriend during a traffic stop for possession of controlled substances. A couple of days later, while the two were still in custody, neighbors started calling in complaints about a horrible smell coming from their property. The officers obtained a search warrant and went to investigate. Inside the house was a disaster. Rotting food everywhere, drugs and paraphernalia scattered about, trash piled high. But nothing that explained the overwhelming stench. That is, until they checked the shed in the backyard. The moment they opened the door, the smell was unbearable. In the center of the shed was a table, and tied to it was a cat. Its limbs had been cut off with a hedge trimmer. Blood and flesh were splattered across the table, walls, and floor. In cages off to the side were another cat and a small dog. They were barely alive, dehydrated and starving, but otherwise unharmed. Thankfully, those two were rescued, nursed back to health, and later adopted. On the walls were dozens of photographs documenting what the couple had done to countless small animals. The shed was essentially a torture chamber. On their computers, investigators later found search history and files indicating the two were sadists, people deriving pleasure from cruelty and suffering. My buddy told me that was one of the hardest scenes he ever walked into. He said the worst part wasn't just the blood or the smell. It was realizing that there are many others out there in the world who enjoy the same kind of depravity. That's what haunted him most. Story 31. I'm a former paramedic, and one of the strangest calls I ever had was responding with police and fire to a report of a man down by the railroad tracks. A railroad worker doing a safety check had spotted him off the embankment in a wooded area about 500 yards from the nearest access road. We had to hike all the gear in. When we reached him, it was immediately clear. No signs of life. Flat line on the monitor, pupils fixed and dilated. The body wasn't cold and rigor mortis hadn't set in, so he hadn't been dead very long. No visible trauma, no track marks, no broken bones. The railroad employee confirmed no trains had come through in the last 8 hours. We searched the area and found a makeshift tent nearby. Looked like he'd been living there, but nothing suspicious. No meds, no drugs, nothing unusual. The place wasn't far from a patch of woods rumored to be haunted, where people claimed satanic rituals happened. Most of us had heard the rumors, but nobody really believed them. We were waiting in the dark for the funeral home to arrive when things got weird. A few of us heard whispering, faint voices, but not from any specific direction. Others thought we were joking. Then the whispering stopped, and suddenly the ones who hadn't heard it began to hear children laughing, high-pitched, cruel, echoing all around, again without a clear source. Strangely, those of us who heard the whispers didn't hear the laughter. It went on for 10 or 15 minutes while we stood there with the body. The officers on scene finally radioed dispatch and told them to get the funeral home there as soon as possible. We helped load the man and got out of there as quickly as possible. The next afternoon, we went to the morgue to check in with the coroner. First thing he asked us was, "Why did you clean the body?" Confused, we told him we hadn't touched it. He said it must have been an extremely bloody scene, because the body had no blood left in it, none at all. No wounds, no punctures, nothing to explain where the blood went. The coroner admitted he had a weird experience during the autopsy, but wouldn't tell us what it was. To this day, the cause of death has never been determined. Story 32. I'm not a cop, but my friend's brother is, and he told us about one of the most disturbing calls he's ever dealt with. In our city, there's a large homeless population, despite the economic boom. Two guys, one full-time homeless, one part-time, would sometimes pool money for a hotel room and drugs. On this night, they were holed up with meth, watching porn and getting high. At one point, the part-time homeless guy said, "I can't get off." The other man responded, "No problem, I've got a remedy. I've done it before. All I need to do is make a small incision at the base, and it'll release the pressure." High out of his mind, the part-time guy agreed. But it wasn't a small incision. The full-time homeless man mutilated him, completely removing everything. Once he realized what he had done, he panicked and left. The victim eventually stumbled outside with a towel pressed to his lap. Someone called 911, thinking it was just another intoxicated homeless man. When paramedics arrived and pulled back the towel, they immediately realized it was something far worse. They rushed him to the hospital and called in police. During scans at the hospital, they found something even more disturbing. Inside the man's stomach were his own severed parts. The full-time homeless man had forced him to consume them. This wasn't even the first time. Turns out it was his second offense of Sewell mutilation. He was arrested and charged with mayhem, a charge that sounds almost too mild for the horror of what he'd done. Story 33. A couple of years ago, while I was a criminal justice student, I went on a ride along in a small mountain town in the Southwest. Dispatch sent us to a check the welfare call. The man in question was a known heavy drinker, hadn't been answering his phone, and hadn't shown up to work for a few days. His family finally called 911. We arrived at his apartment, and things went downhill fast. The officer broke the lock, and the instant the door opened, the stench of death hit me like a wall. The carpet was mostly torn up, bedbugs, I was told, and already my skin crawled. We climbed a set of bare wooden stairs that led into the kitchen. Every surface was littered with empty tall cans of beer, and the floor was coated with them like a sea of blue aluminum. The smell of decomposition was so strong it was hard to breathe. When we entered the bedroom, I wasn't ready for what I saw. The man, partially undressed and probably drunk at the time, had slipped and hit his head on the hot radiator. He'd passed out on top of it, and the radiator had burned into him for so long that one entire side of his body was cooked. Eventually, his body ruptured, bursting open like some grotesque balloon across the floor and wall. Dried blood was everywhere, flies buzzing in the thick air. It was the most horrific thing I had ever witnessed, and the memory of it has never left me. Story 34. I was working the midnight shift when, around 2 a.m., we were dispatched to a large, beautiful house off a quiet state road. The CAD system flagged it as an animal problem. The note read, "Elderly female has some sort of animal inside her residence." I had a ride along with me that night. When we knocked, a sweet old lady answered. I asked what was wrong, and she calmly told me there was an animal in her upstairs bedroom that wouldn't leave. I asked what kind. She described it as 3 to 4 feet tall, with large pointed teeth and glowing red eyes. I suggested it might be a raccoon or possum. She shook her head and said, "No, it's bigger, it's a demon." I glanced at my rider. We exchanged a what the hell look, but followed her in. The family room we passed through was crammed wall to wall with porcelain dolls and samurai swords, which only added to the creep factor. In the front room, her husband lay in a hospital bed. His eyes were wide open, staring blankly at the ceiling. For a second, I couldn't even tell if he was alive. When I spoke to him, his head slowly turned toward me and he whispered hello. The old woman pointed me toward the stairs. I unholstered my weapon, better safe than sorry, and began climbing. The house was silent, the hallway long and dark, with her bedroom at the very end. I opened the door and swept the room. Nothing. Empty. I turned to tell her that the room was clear when she said, in the creepiest voice I've ever heard, "Don't you see it? It's pointing at you." That was enough for me. I told my rider, "We're leaving." We didn't run, but we got out of that house fast. I've dealt with every kind of chaotic, bloody, and tragic call you can imagine. But that night, an old woman, her dying husband, porcelain dolls, samurai swords, and a demon pointing at me shook me in a way nothing else ever has. Story 35. We got a call from a man claiming there were people in his backyard peering into his bedroom window. It was about 9:30 at night, and I arrived at the house with a backup unit. When my partner knocked, the door swung open on its own. We called out, identifying ourselves, and heard a faint voice from down the hall. "I'm in the bedroom." Inside, we found a frail, ghost-pale man lying in bed, balding, thin, and wearing pajamas. He stayed under the covers, trembling. We asked if he could roll down the blankets so we could be sure there were no weapons, but he refused, saying he was terrified of them. When we pressed him on who they were, he whispered, "The kids outside. They're pumping gas into the ceiling. Government gas. It happens while I sleep." Around his bed were piles of prescription bottles. It didn't take long to realize he was suffering from severe mental illness, possibly made worse by improper mixing of his meds. We called paramedics to evaluate him and had the fire department check the house just in case there really was a gas leak. Then things took a darker turn. While searching the home with the fire...
When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So, Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card. The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
Fire crew, one firefighter shouted for us. We rushed into another bedroom and found two bodies lying in bed. They had been dead for weeks. The smell was overwhelming, and it was hard to believe it hadn't spread through the rest of the house. It turned out the man was a Desert Storm veteran with severe mental and physical health issues. He had been the caretaker for his elderly parents, the same two people we found dead. The medical examiner couldn't determine an exact cause of death because of the level of decomposition, but investigators reported puncture wounds on both of their necks that didn't look natural. It left us with a chilling suspicion. The man might have been responsible, even if he couldn't or wouldn't admit it. Story 36. My brother-in-law has been in law enforcement for over 2 decades, and for a time he was a training officer. Whenever he signed off on a rookie, he made sure they knew they could reach out to him anytime if they faced a tough call. One new officer did just that during his first week. He told my brother-in-law about a domestic call where an ex-husband showed up at his ex-mother-in-law's house and threatened his ex-wife. The altercation never escalated beyond some grabbing, and the rookie served the man a restraining order right there. Still, he worried he hadn't done enough. Not long after, my brother-in-law was out on patrol when he heard that same address come across the radio. He knew instantly something terrible had happened. He arrived first on scene. The ex-wife was in the front yard, screaming incoherently, shot in the leg. The front door was open. Inside, the ex-mother-in-law was slumped on the couch, a fatal gunshot to the head. Down the hall, their young son lay dead in his bedroom, also shot. In the master bedroom, the father had taken his daughter's life before killing himself. Later, when the ex-wife gave her statement, she revealed the most chilling detail. After shooting her in the leg, he had dragged her outside and told her, "This is your fault. You're the one who has to live with this." It was one of the darkest, most disturbing calls my brother-in-law ever faced, and it haunted that rookie forever. Story 37. In a small town, the calls that stick with you aren't always violent crimes. They're the ones that creep under your skin. One night around 3 a.m., we got a call from an elderly woman with dementia. She told dispatch there was a baby hanging inside her grandfather's clock. When I got there, her house was mostly dark except for a single lamp glowing in the living room. She pointed at the clock, trembling, insisting she could see the baby. I knew immediately she was hallucinating, but the image she described still chills me when I think about it. That call gave me a new level of sympathy for those suffering dementia or schizophrenia. Living with those visions, seeing or hearing intruders in your home every night, must be terrifying. Another night, during a snowstorm, a plow truck got hit by a train. The call came in strangely casual. Train versus plow truck, no injuries. I walked up the tracks expecting a clipped bumper or maybe a driver who jumped out in time. Instead, I found the plow truck mangled in a pond beside the tracks, the train long gone. Floating in the freezing water was a yellow jacket with two boots sticking out. The driver had been ejected when the train hit him at 65 miles per hour. He died instantly. I remember blurting out, "What the f-?" before composing myself enough to radio in. That one was rough. And I'll never forget my first unresponsive person call, just a week out of the academy, still with my training officer. We arrived before medics. The patient was a 30-year-old man, completely naked in bed with three fans blowing on him. My FTO did a sternum rub, and the man moaned and opened his eyes. I went downstairs to get info from his mother while medics carried him down. Halfway down the stairs, I heard one medic say, "He doesn't look good," and another answer, "He's not, he just coded." As they carried him past me, his eyes were wide open, staring straight through me. It was the first time I'd seen that empty look of death, and it rattled me. Thankfully, this one had a happy ending. The medics brought him back on the way to the hospital, but the memory of his dead stare, even for that brief moment, still lingers.